Welcome to Galaxy Brains. As always, I'm your host, Alex Thorne, head of firm-wide research at Galaxy. Thank you for listening. We have a great show. No rap intro this week, but we'll be back soon with some more. We do have a great guest. Will Nelly from Galaxy Ventures is joining us to talk about the current venture capital market. Is it back? I mean, my report at the end of last year showed that Q4 was still putting in new lows in terms of capital invested, but the energy feels different. We're going to get Will's thoughts on this. Will's also a noted expert on the concept of block space and blockchains, and we'll have a fascinating conversation about how he thinks about block space as a consumer good. That's quite interesting. We'll also check with our good friend Bibnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading, as always, to discuss markets and macro. Before we get to that, I need to remind you to please refer to the link to the disclaimer in the podcast notes. Note that none of the information in this podcast constitutes investment advice or an offer recommendation, solicitation by Galaxy Digital or any of its affiliates to buy or sell any securities. Let's hop right into the show. Let's go now to our friend Bibnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading. As always, Bibnet, welcome to Galaxy Brains.
Thanks for having me.
I'm not there. We took a week off last week. You were off. I was traveling. I still am. But there was big news last week. It was a Fed day last Wednesday. And rates were unchanged, but you know, even from far away, I heard, I saw, and heard rumors that there was more dovish than expected, maybe language or something. Why don't you tell us what happened last week?
Yes. Yeah, so the big focus going into the Fed last week was the dot plot, and a lot of market participants had expected the 2024 dots to go down from three cuts to two cuts, and so when that didn't happen, the market perceived that as dovish, even though you know, the Fed did upgrade their growth forecasts and the dots further out the curve moved higher. However, you know, the market most closely latched onto the 2024 dots because, you know, that's immediate monetary policy. In addition, I would say Powell was fairly dovish during his press conference. You know, he dismissed things like, you know, the equity market and kind of some of the froth in financial markets. He reiterated the fact that he thought, you know, financial conditions were tight right now, even though I don't think that they're really that tight. And, you know, just he stuck to the script, and, you know, he thinks that it's feasible that, you know, they still cut three times this year. And, you know, I personally, in the face of the strong data we've had, especially recently around CPI, PPI, I would not have taken such a dovish stance. And I think a lot of market participants didn't expect him to be as dovish as he was, because realistically, you can make an argument that you don't need to cut at all this year. In fact, the day after FOMC, or on Friday after FOMC, you know, Bostic, another Fed member, came out and said he only saw one cut happening this year. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as the economy develops, like, I mean, just think about this. They lowered their unemployment forecast and they increased their growth forecast, and yet they're still cutting the same amount. Right. Even though the data is hot and they've literally had to adjust their forecast because of how hot the data has been. And yet, you know, we're still talking about the same number of cuts. And I think it's really foolhardy. What you're seeing in goods inflation is, you know, some signs of revival, right? Like, you know, oil prices have started to climb. You know, I don't know if you've seen charts of cocoa prices recently, things of that nature. A lot of it's structural because, like you can't really go much lower in terms of prices. And then, you know, just, you know, high level, I think there are upside risks to goods inflation, and services inflation is already pretty hot. And so I genuinely think that the Fed shouldn't be as dovish as they are. And then from the level of, like, what have we really done over the past couple of years? Like, prices are still up a lot in aggregate. The price level of goods has been way higher than the, you know, 2% inflation rate that folks, you know, were being told. Like, if a cup of coffee is now $4 at your local Starbucks that was $2 2 years ago, right? Like, just because it's only going from $4 to $4.15 in this year, people are like, you know, and Fed members are like, oh, like, we've dramatically cooled inflation. Like, yeah, but you know, at the end of the day, what have you really done? And that's facilitated, you know, one of the largest bouts of inflation like that, you know, we've had in modern history. And like, has that really been addressed? Will it ever be addressed? Are incomes keeping up fast enough, you know, for, you know, the price level of goods? Like, I don't know. And it's also like a tale of two halves. Like anybody with assets in financial markets is feeling pretty good. Stock markets are all time highs. Home prices are keeping up. And so, you know, but yet if you're living paycheck to paycheck, like it's, you know, it's a much different world.
Yeah, for sure. It does seem like cutting doesn't make a ton of sense when assets are at all time highs and unemployment's doing okay, right? I mean, I know you're on the sort of, in the last few months, you've turned to sort of the hawkish side of this, which has been really interesting. Let's talk quickly about a little bit more global macro. I saw a headline that said the Japanese yen dropped to the lowest value against the dollar in, I don't know, I think it said since 1990. So that would be like 35 years. What does that mean? What's going on in Japan? Did they abandon yield curve control? What's happening over there? The third or fourth largest economy in the world?
Depends if you group the EU together, but yeah, it's the third largest economy in the world, and I guess fourth if you loop in the EU and China. So, you know, it's a pretty big deal, and it's even more important from the standpoint that they were the only central bank, at least in G10 markets, that hadn't, you know, lifted off from zero or negative, actually. And so, you know, what the BOJ did was basically end, you know, this huge experiment in monetary easing recently. And they, you know, are abandoning ETF purchases. They're raising the overnight rate back to zero. And, you know, they have already, you know, widened out the band of you know, where back-end JGB rates can trade. You know, don't get it twisted. Like, they still have pretty easy monetary policy, but, you know, they announced a pretty big shift, and that was a natural reaction to some of the things they were seeing. Literally, like, you know, this month you've had huge concessions by, you know, large companies to their labor unions in Japan. And so wage inflation has been, you know, a pretty hot figure in Japan. And then, you know, generally, like, you know, their economy's been doing well, super, super low unemployment. And so, you know, they're starting to see, you know, prices pick up. They reacted and got off of zero. And that was a big deal because generally when you get off of zero, you're sending a pretty strong signal to the market that you're, you know, gonna react to positive price pressure. Because that's what central banks are supposed to do. And so it was a pretty big deal for them to shift, but it was well communicated. And the currency only continued to depreciate after, basically. And so now, you know, given the huge interest rate differentials that still exist between BOJ, the ECB, and the Fed, and basically every central bank on the planet, like, the yen is going to continue to depreciate unless, you know, the BOJ gets more aggressive in monetary policy, or that there's actually some form of currency intervention.
All right, real quick, before we – I know market's about to open. We're recording this on Wednesday, March 27th, before U.S. market open. I just want to ask you, Bim, when I left 2 weeks ago for vacation, we had just started a drop below 70K to this sort of correction that we've had. I think saw about 17% Bitcoin price decline. We're back at like 71.5 now. Maybe by the time I get back to New York next week, will we be like it never happened? What's that last 2 weeks been like in crypto markets for you in your mind? And does any of this matter? Is this just some short-term noise?
I genuinely think that it's just short-term noise. I mean, the flows we've seen are still pretty substantial. You know, Bitcoin's an asset class that's here to stay. Risk markets and risk assets are trading super well, especially things like fiat debasement hedges, like gold. and so I think that's a good risk environment. The fundamentals are there. More platforms, you know, bringing on the Bitcoin ETFs. You know, more reputable institutions, you know, playing and forcing other, you know, players to come in. I think you'll see some of that, you know, after 13F filings. You know, there's a pathway to options getting listed on the ETF as well. And more and more markets are opening up to the Bitcoin ETF. And so, you know, I think this adoption story is one that continues. And the price action that you've had recently, testing, you know, 60K or 61 and change, you know, a bunch of, you know, moving average supports and bouncing right back is highly constructive. It shows that, you know, it's an asset that's well supported, and it's an asset that's becoming more institutionalized because, as we know, you know, institutions are generally dip buyers. Yeah, you've had some healthy developments, you know, BlackRock launching that on-chain, you know, money market fund. And, you know, generally, the ETH ETF commentary hasn't been that great. And you guys, you know, Galaxy Research has a great piece, you know, talking about that. But, you know, in alts, like memes are still trading well and stuff. So, you know, I think this is a healthy market. It just went through a correction, but it's likely going to continue to trend higher. Trend is your friend.
Yeah, there you go. Bimnet Abibi, my friend from Galaxy Trading. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let's go now to our guest, Will Nelly, general partner at Galaxy Ventures. Welcome to Galaxy Brains, Will.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a long time coming.
It has.
We've been trying to make this happen for a little bit.
It has. So when I joined Galaxy, Will, it was very clear to me that Will was one of the smartest people on blockchain technology that I had met, and it's only been further proven true. And we have some interesting, slightly esoteric topics for those interested in blockchain technology. Luckily, I know our audience is, so that I wanted to dig in with Will. But first, I want to ask you just what's going on in venture right now. It's Q1. 2024.
Yep.
Obviously, you know, Bitcoin is up. The liquid assets are ripping.
Yep.
But venture, as of the data we published at the end of Q4, was still making in new lows and deals. Maybe that will change when we refresh the data. But what are the vibes out here? Are you guys very busy all of a sudden, or more busy than last year?
Yeah. The first quarter of the year has been basically a busier time than almost any in my career at Galaxy, as you know, working on and leading the venture team here. I think when the market, you know, when the broader liquid market comes back, it gives investors this feeling of a margin of safety on their investments that, that they kind of lean into. I mean, you see it in the data historically, right? Every time, you know, Bitcoin rips, there's a lag, right, that follows in venture funding. Obviously, venture deals, they'll get done at one time and then they'll get announced something like 3 to 6 months later. There's some variation there. And so there's a natural lag in the data. But historically, it's, you know, that venture funding number has always, especially on the downside, as prices come down, venture funding stays high until investors kind of get the message. I think it tracks a little bit closer than that real deep lag because of the announcement delay. I would say the Q4 was busy actually too in 2022, as I think people were anticipating the market coming back. And then Q1, starting really in the beginning of January, but especially picking up in mid and late January, has been some of the most frenetic, I think, venture investing markets that I've seen. One of the reaction functions ultimately that causes that is projects which spent, since 2021 or 2022, feeling like they couldn't go out to raise because, you know, it's going to take a lot. They might be able to get it done because they're great companies, but it's going to take a lot of time to actually get it done because investors are investing less, funding is down, and so they don't go out to market. They don't want to spend 6 months trying to fundraise. And so the second the word gets out that investors are kind of back in the market, then then a ton of teams come back out to raise.
Yeah.
Of course, this is exactly as an investor, the time you want to be investing less. You want to have sort of deployed in great opportunities in the previous year when it was slower, and sort of valuations were a little more compressed. It's this moment when everybody rushes back out at sort of more, you know, more bountiful valuations that you want to be most careful.
Right.
On the converse, teams that haven't raised since 2021, they might be raising their only round for, you know, the next 24 months, and there is a kind of game you have to play, right? And so, you know, this might be your opportunity for 2 years to invest in some particular company you've been tracking and speaking with for that time. And so you do have to play the game. You have to be very cautious and disciplined on valuation at times like this, because you have this feeling of the margin of safety with the market going up and up and up. And then, as we know, you know, it especially in this industry, it turns.
It can come down.
It turns quickly.
Yeah.
But you know, we've at the, you know, for ventures at Galaxy, historically, we've maintained a generally very steady pace of deployment, and we continue to see great entrepreneurial activity and, you know, great sort of crypto native talent as well as more traditional talent that's building in this industry, and that really hasn't changed and remains true in, you know, in Q1 of 2024.
Yeah.
I do expect the numbers to be substantially higher for Q1 of 2024.
So it is definitely a lot busier.
It is very active.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you were also telling me before we started that in our data, which we publish quarterly crypto VC deal reports, yeah. Which you can see on galaxy.com/research, we had, and we did this sort of right at the end of Q4. We had Q4 putting in yet actually a new low in capital deployed by venture capitalists into early stage crypto startups. It was like 1.something billion, I forget, but yeah. Not still lower than the prior quarter. You were saying that once we refresh every time when we do the Q1 24 report, we'll refresh the data from Q4 23.
Yep.
We don't just use the existing data. We go back right. to capture any late announcements.
Right.
And you're saying that you actually think Q4 will end up being bigger than Q3, that actually Q3 of last year might have been the bottom, not Q4.
Yeah, if I had to guess, that's true. Again, announcements typically happen, let's call it on average, 3 months following, but it sometimes 6 months, sometimes a year even.
I know.
We really, you know, so there really is a lag to when the announcements are made. So I'd suspect Q3 ends up as the bottom, which is represented in Q4 data.
Yeah.
And then Q4 ends up, which are announced in Q1 ends up higher. And then Q2 of 2024 should be a sort of discontinuous jump.
Yeah.
If I had to sort of guess here.
There were a lot of teams that either, like you said, didn't want to raise on the startup side because the valuations might have been too low, or there wasn't a lot of capital. A lot of the generalist VCs really weren't around during the recent bear market
right.
we had, although crypto native VCs like yourself were. Mm-hmm. And so maybe they couldn't get the capital, or they didn't like the terms they were seeing, blah, blah, blah. So they were grinding.
Right.
And hunkering down. And this is, I guess this is what you were kind of saying of like the game that may be played. They may see the frenetic activity as, okay, now is the time for us to go out and raise because people are opening their checkbooks and they're, yeah.
Exactly. And I mean, but even for, you know, GPs, obviously Galaxy, you know, we invest off the balance sheet of the company. And so it's a little bit of a different sort of capital base than other venture funds in the industry have. But they're the logic isn't that different for GPs either, right?
Right, right.
Where it was very hard to raise LP dollars in 2022, post FTX, but ending in May of 2022, and especially in 2023, there weren't, you know, it wasn't a great environment for GPs and funds to fundraise.
Right, right.
And so you can't, you know, they don't fill their coffers, and so they, you know, they don't know when the next fund is coming and how big, and so you invest more slowly and more patiently. And of course, now, you know, it remains to be seen. I think the institutional allocator community is still trying to understand what the use cases are in crypto. I don't think it's, you know, it's a case where their 2021 LP allocation activity was also frenetic.
And yeah, it
I
was.
Think that group is trying to get a handle on what the real use cases beyond speculation is for cryptocurrencies. Thankfully, being at the early stage venture, in the early stage venture seat for Galaxy, I am extremely confident in the long-term use cases for blockchains beyond, you know, trading use cases. We're seeing a ton in payments and stable coins. That's exciting for us. You know, we are probably going to publish a kind of analysis soon, Mike Giampapa and I, on what we're seeing in stable coins being used for payments,
that's
in
great.
Particular for cross-border payments, B2B, you know, B2C, cross-border payments, instead of using SWIFT, using stable coins, it's a 10x better.
Yeah, no-brainer.
10x better product, and it's just, we're seeing secular growth. It's just at early, early stages right now of that secular growth, and so, so we're going to spend some time sharing with the world about that trend, and so that's some of the stuff we're seeing, and I think that question will get answered quickly for you know, institutional allocators that, yes, payments with stablecoins on blockchain rails are a 10x better financial product than you know, moving fiat over Swift,
yeah.
right? And then it kind of trickles from there. What, you know, then do you use stablecoins for payments on over domestic systems or sort of domestic payments? You know, and then, of course, as we look more forward into things like tokenization, using kind of all the financial infrastructure that's been built on chain and DeFi and the general market structure of crypto that we've invested in and has been developed for the last, you know, really 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, yeah, very exciting. I mean, I think the stablecoin one is one of the most potent, like non-Bitcoin narratives. I think there's a lot of demand in the world now, growing. I mean, growing demand for digitally distributed, non-sovereign, fixed supply, inelastic supply FX. That's the Bitcoin story. But beyond that, we have all these other big ideas that people have had and built.
Yeah.
Stables is obviously the killer app for tokenization so far.
Yep.
Part of me wonders if, first of all, it's just ludicrous, that, like, even at a bank right now, I'm like, can I send money to this thing or withdraw from a Fidelity account? Yep. Like, dude, stables should already be an option. Like, it's ready. Like, stable coins are already ready for large volumes with all the L2s and stuff. So that's a clear one.
And just to highlight, like, you don't really need to even know you're transacting in stablecoins. And that's, I think, the change that's made this really work, especially in the last, let's call it 18 to 24 months. But, you know, this is a process, right? It's a, we kind of bottoms up think it's roughly a $15 billion market in terms of gross payment volume on a per year basis. That's from looking at kind of the traction of individual companies.
Mm-hmm.
It's growing 50% quarter over quarter. But you don't really have to know as a corporate that you're, or as a non-crypto corporate that you're using stablecoins in the back end. The workflow that we're seeing is fiat to stablecoins, stablecoins across the world, and then stablecoins out to a different fiat.
So whatever you need, basically.
You might send, you know, you might want to go US dollar to a Singaporean bank account in Singapore, you know, SGD.
Yeah.
And you might go US dollar to USDT, USDT across the world over Tron, strangely enough.
Yeah.
Block, the actual chain itself is somewhat variable.
I agree.
There's some flexibility there. And then you go USDT to Singaporean dollar. And so what you need is really the market structure to be in place to make that transaction between that make the market between dollars and Tether, and then Tether to Singaporean dollars. And once you solve that problem, you've made a 10x better product, both on cost and on speed.
Yeah.
So we're seeing that you don't even, if you're the corporate who's using it, who's, you know, you might be sending to a subsidiary in Singapore or sending money to a vendor or vice versa, you don't even need to know that it's stablecoins on the back end. You are avoiding 2 to 4 days over Swift, and it's a much better product. So that these are the companies we're seeing now are at seed, Series A, and maybe the largest at the Series B stages. In 3 years, 4 years, they'll be at the Series E stages, and then people will understand it, and the scale of that opportunity will, you know, won't dwarf the kind of the, you know, Bitcoin as money and the opportunity with Bitcoin and DeFi and Ethereum, but it's going to be a identifiable macro trend at that point that is visible because it's not at $15 billion a year in GMV over stablecoins. It's, you know, it's much more at that point.
Those bigger startups that have grown over that period, they can more credibly then sell to the bigger companies themselves, right?
Exactly.
So it's not just like an interesting U.S. Singapore company. It could be like, you know, the big tech companies now all start using it because they have a large enough partner.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, look, that's kind of the S curve that you talk about, right? Like, there's at some point where it reaches, like, it becomes big enough where it saturates the largest markets in the world, and then eventually they get so saturated that there's not enough new market to capture, which creates the shape of the S curve, right?
Right, right.
And I think we're pretty much at the very early stages of that particular S curve. I mean, if you look at just the size of the market for cross-border B2B payments in particular, it's $37 trillion a year in payment volume. It's $200 billion a year in revenue
Wow.
just from that market. You know, and a lot of that doesn't all go. It kind of gets it gets parceled among the sort of Byzantine players in the payments, you know, payment space and banks and FX providers. A lot of it ends up on banks' income statements, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And banks, in some ways, have handicapped themselves at the knees because they can't touch. They don't really touch crypto.
Yeah.
And so it leaves a massive opportunity for new players to gain market share. We're spending a lot of time there. We pair that, obviously, with a real fundamental view on the underlying infrastructure that you should use. I mean, Tron, I mentioned Tron had really remarkable distribution.
I mean, I've explained this question before when people are like, why is there so much Tether on Tron? And I'm like, well, first of all, it's an Ethereum clone, so it's the same tech. It was easy. Before all the L2s, it was the easy, fast alt ETH clone that that exchanges could add, so they did. It's fast and cheap, and sure, it doesn't have the same level of settlement assurances that, say, Ethereum or other chains do, but with tokenized assets, that doesn't really matter.
Right, exactly.
Not in the same way it matters for natively digital assets. Yeah. Right? Yeah. If something happens to Tron, then everybody can Tether can just make a facility that says, come here with your Tron wallet that had that Tether in it, sign this message, and we'll just reissue, we'll cancel those Tethers and give them to you on ETH or something. So, like, it's not, they can go elsewhere, too. It matters. But if we step back, I wanted to ask about the underlying infrastructure to beyond Tron and stables. Like, you also, and this is a good segue to what we want to talk about, you guys do a lot on new protocols, blockchain technology design, and a bunch of other stuff, too. But let's talk about that. What are the trends that you're seeing in blockchain technology?
Yeah, it's actually really, really interesting, the mention of Tron. I don't think we anticipated
that. I don't want the audience to think that we're like huge investors in the Tron ecosystem or anything.
but it is interesting because I published recently in November, I think, and I have a second version that I presented on at ETH Denver, which I'm going to turn into a kind of written piece.
Yeah.
Where we do we want to do a real analysis of block space as a business model, right? And this idea, just to go back to Tron for a second, this idea of why Tron succeeded, you're right. At that time, it was an EVM-compatible chain. It was the lowest-cost chain at the time. It provided some really interesting benefits to the particular use cases that were existing on it. And fundamentally, it created a network effect, right? And there's now a network effect around capital on Tron, around liquidity on Tron, and for people in the payments ecosystem specifically, of integrations, like infrastructure integrations. You need the things you have to think about when you're talking about a network effect. If you want people to use your blockchain, you need Fireblocks to support your blockchain, right? You need so that people can transact on it. You need sort of on-ramps and off-ramps to support it. You need market makers who are providing that USDT to USD leg to be there accepting deposits or accepting transfers in and sending transfers out on that infrastructure. You need, I think in a DeFi context, you need, if you're going to talk about like smart contract DEXs or exchanges, you need liquidity in those contracts. And so there's this really, and just to maybe to zoom out and how we think about block space, it is I think the market has to get towards thinking about block space as a product that's sold to the market, not this ephemeral kind of like thing that blockchains produce that people, that people consume as they're using blockchains, which is kind of a public good. It is a public good and it's built as a public good. It's decentralized. There's no, the beneficiaries or owners of that are the kind of, token holders of the systems themselves. But at the end of the day, block space is a product that's consumed by users, right? Mm. It's a consumer product in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a degree to which it's B2B2C because you sell, if you're a blockchain like Ethereum, you're really selling to application developers who then go on and sell their application to users or the consumption of their application to users. Mm-hmm. And that's the frame of reference or the frame of mind that we have in the venture team on block space. We're looking for, when we're investing in new blockchains, L1s, L2s, data availability, obviously we were really excited about our investment in Celestia, and that was really differentiated their offering, and we could talk about that. We've come to think about block space as like basically one of four categories that has the opportunity for robust, repeatable product market fit in the space. I mean, investors are, especially venture capital investors, are in the business fundamentally not of finding new technologies, but finding new business models, mm-hmm. right? And finding how new technologies create new business models. This was the case of search, of course, with Google. The new technology that Google brought to the table, which was PageRank and enhanced search capabilities, created the new business model of sort of eyeballs and advertising to all the eyeballs. Like, that was the business model innovation.
Yeah.
So we think about basically the four categories of product market fit in crypto today are software businesses. This is a traditional SaaS, you know, SaaS businesses, Fireblocks, you know, Alchemies of the world. You could kind of put like some of the staking as a service provider. These are the big infrastructure players that are providing software. The second category is exchanges. Their tendency to financialize everything in crypto is really conducive to product market fit. Exchanges make huge profits, really great at unit economics. Binance and Coinbase and so on are kind of, you know, the proof is in the pudding there. We think about this, and this is a more complicated category, net interest margin businesses. I leave it broad like that. This is both lending businesses, like a lot of what Galaxy does, you know, from our trading division, mm-hmm. as well as stablecoin providers. Stablecoins are at really, in some ways, net interest margin businesses, you know, that are capturing a spread versus on yield versus deposits. Then the fourth category is like really the sale of block space.
Yeah.
To consumers, right? As a category of product market fit. And if you ranked the four categories in terms of annual revenues, and I've kind of roughly done this math, exchanges are actually the most profitable category in terms of generating the most top line revenue. Mm-hmm. Net interest margins businesses, arguably because of stablecoins, are the second most profitable because the NIM is so wide.
I mean, you're talking about like Tether's giant pile of treasuries, and they pass zero of the interest back to the token holders. So it's just
And like the NIM is so big for them right now, particularly because treasury yields are very high, and so I expect that one to come, at least the profitability of that business to kind of in aggregate come down over time. As I mean, you just look at the history of banks' net interest margins, and it shouldn't be the entire treasury
combination
rate,
of treasuries rates coming down and growing demand over worldwide to pass some of that back to the holders.
And just in stack ranking, like the exchanges, hard to say exactly the revenue per year because I don't. Off the top of my head, no Binance's revenues. And like a lot of those are private companies, but it's well, and if I had to sort of put a finger on it, it's well in excess of $10 billion a year in sort of gross revenues. For stablecoin, net interest margin businesses, mostly stablecoins in practice, it's probably around 5 to 6 per year. These are really rough numbers because I haven't done the exact math. I mean, blockchains, block space, the analysis I've done, and we have databases and real-time feeds that track transaction fees paid to, you know, all the major blockchain environments. Last year, by my analysis, it was $2.8 billion of transaction fees bought from blockchains, paid to use block space. So, and then the fourth category, software businesses, is probably around a billion in gross revenues. So you can see the stack ranking of the four categories. Block space is that third category. I think it expands from here. I think it eventually goes to number two, maybe depending on the relationship between DEXs and SEXs in the long term, maybe to number one. But it's the most interesting business model. And just to highlight it for a second, it's also the most novel fundamentally.
Right.
It's essentially like selling cloud compute. It's like selling Amazon EC2 compute, except with some really distinct properties. And just to highlight them.
Yeah.
The first is network effects. Amazon EC2 cloud computing has economies of scale, not network effects. Block space fundamentally has network effects around capital, liquidity, application deployments, developers, et cetera.
Right. One app by itself doing well on a blockchain is good, but better if there's a whole ecosystem.
Extremely hard to disrupt, for example, in an environment like Ethereum, where a ton of people have deployed billions of dollars of capital in thousands of applications, right?
Right.
Where there's a huge developer community, there's hackathons all over the world. It's really hard to disrupt, right? And so network effects is one of the key criteria. The other one is actually like high profitability. I know that sounds surprising, but like these are, if you just, you know, we'll link to my analysis.
Yeah, we will in the show notes. So check that out.
You know, there are really high gross margins in the long term, and really high net income margins. There's no real OPEX to blockchains. Everything is basically paid out as like a direct cost, right? So everything is COGS, cost of goods sold, for people, where you're paying out validators to basically provide the service to the network. But beyond paying out the validators, there's no other real expenses. It's not like Uber, for example, which has to pay out drivers, but then has the big corp that they have to, you know, pay out OPEX to, right? Yep. It's like as if almost, you know, running Ethereum is almost as if the drivers were sort of essentially running their own computer network to actually do all the routing algorithm and run and essentially orchestrate the sort of driver network on, you know, on Ethereum or something. So there's some really interesting properties. The negative is, in comparison to SaaS, there's high cyclicality to the to block space. It sort of ebbs and flows, both as the with the general demand for trading volume, as well as I think for exchanges more broadly.
But yeah, the cyclicality of fees on transaction fees on blockchains is well known.
Yeah.
And it has positive feedback loops. So like as fees go up, people stop paying, they go to cheaper block space environments. Yeah. Well, but then the high fees end up creating innovations that make it cheaper and faster. So then they come back and then they go back. And you see that with alt L1 rotation trading. Yeah. You'll see it now with the L2s.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, I love the way that you think about this, about block space. I wanted to ask you, there was the Dankun upgrade on Ethereum this week. It creates a new type of block space on Ethereum. They call them blobs. It stands for something actually, but we'll just call them blobs. It's a nice acronym.
Yeah, sure.
It's actually somewhat similar to SegWit on Bitcoin. I made this point several times and people are like, no, it's different. I'm like, well, it's a segregated space for data of a certain type. I mean, SegWit did multiple things, but it did also enable Lightning in a similar way, also in L2 on Bitcoin, in a similar way that blobs now on Ethereum are sort of segregated block space for roll-up data.
Right.
And if they use it, they pay less, right?
Right.
Something. What's your take on that as a block space aficionado?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think we're all in the spirit, we're all here in service of the belief that, like, there is more demand for block space in 10 years than there is today. I'm a believer that generally financial services use cases will consume a ton of block space in the future. I mean, as you, like, let's just think about this. As you bring, you know, we all kind of saw the highlights yesterday from Dankun. It brought, you know, L2 transaction fees from 20 cents to a tenth of a cent, right? Which, you know, Solana's been doing really cheap block space for a long time, so it's nothing new. I think the demand on Solana has pushed that to on the order of about a cent per transaction.
Right.
I think, again, the new Dankun blob space is artificially cheap as demand will continue to build for this blob space, and so it will, you know, eventually trend up towards a cent. But you think about, like, the induced demand as you bring costs down, right? Like, now, if you can run an order book, a central limit order book, just as an example application, on an L2 for a tenth of a cent, the market making, so you can't really run a central limit order book on an L2 today, because the unit economics for market makers and generally market participants, when you are sending an order and then you want to cancel it or reposition your spread, is it costs 20 cents to just cancel an order, and you're trying to do that, like, you know,
hundreds of thousands of times a minute
or something something like that. It's fundamentally unworkable. But when you're talking about a tenth of a cent, it really transforms the unit economics of the applications that can work on top of these environments. And so it takes time, but I anticipate induced demand on that Dankun opens up, and generally the new blob space opens up. people have been saying this for a long time about Solana, like, okay, we can run all these new applications, which is, I'm super supportive of that, and that's all well and good. The thing is, as I said, there's strong network effects around these systems, right? There's network effects around the EVM. Solidity and the EVM have become a standard, not the only possible standard, but a standard for blockchain development. And it's almost like JavaScript, right? Maybe a slightly suboptimal language, but kind of just, you know, just had some virality and had some staying power.
They even say TCIP, TCP/IP.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the best packet transfer protocol, but the winner.
Yeah.
And certainly good enough. I mean, that's the thing. Before we wrap, I wanted to ask you too, in light of this, so in light of, let's say, Dankun and the rollups, which are working and are widely adopted and will get even more performant, and when ZK rollups become widely used, perhaps even safer or more private or faster, whatever. There's more technology there, but they clearly work today.
Yeah.
And a large swath or most of the Ethereum ecosystem basically just considers them part of Ethereum, and now they can be cheaper as well. You mentioned Solana. Solana is, I've been talking about, I think we think, just objectively looking at user data adoption metrics, is sort of the third chain behind Bitcoin and ETH. Does, and there are still yet new performant L1s that are either just launched or going to launch, but what do you think the Ethereum as the central hub with these now increasingly performant and inexpensive L2s as the spokes, does Dankun signal the start of the resurgence of Ethereum against something like a Solana or other high-performant alt L1s? In 10 years, do we need anything else beyond Bitcoin and Ethereum, or will there still definitely be others in your mind?
Yeah. First and foremost, it's a hard network effect to disrupt. That's the point with network effects, is like they have staying power because there's concentration there. So I think it's generally hard to disrupt in the same way that Solana is Solana is building a network effect today, right? It is building, you know, as applications, users, and generally attention flock to Solana, it is in the process of building a strong network effect that I think cements it as you said, the third, you know, the third major player. But my view is like Bitcoin is in that lane, and the critique that once you open it up to Ethereum, which is not as much about money per se and more about programmability and application deployments, like we're somewhere up the S curve on I think new technology on in terms of smart contracting platforms, and I'd probably say we're halfway up the S curve in terms of like blockchain design and deployment. I'm seeing new ideas. There are new ideas out there. We are investing in new ideas and new environments. The North Star is like they have to be differentiated enough to build a network effect long term. Mm-hmm. If they can't build a network effect, they're going to be in the useless part of the power law distribution. We want them to be in the fat tail of the power law distribution. But we're certainly going to continue investing in new ideas that, you know, can build a network effect like Solana. I expect Ethereum to have staying power. I expect Solana to have staying power. But, you know, I don't think the generation of blockchain design and new ideas there is over. I mean, I talked to a really fascinating team this morning with some really fascinating ideas about consensus. And I know there's lots of ideas as well about parallelization of execution that are powerful. So we're 50% of the way through the story, I think.
It's really interesting. My friend Will Nelly from Galaxy Ventures, thank you so much for coming on Galaxy Brains.
Thanks, Alex.
That's it for this week's episode of Galaxy Brains. Thank you to our guest Will Nelly from Galaxy Ventures and our friend Bimnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading, as always. Everyone have a safe and happy weekend, and we will see you next week. Thanks for listening to Galaxy Brains, the weekly podcast from Galaxy Research. If you enjoy the show, please like, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. To follow Galaxy Research, sign up for our weekly newsletter at gdr.email, read our content at galaxy.com/research, and follow us on Twitter at GLXY Research. See you next week.